Well, good evening and welcome. I'm David Held. It's a pleasure for me this evening to welcome our speakers and to introduce the final lecture in the Center's series, Global Civil Society and Global Finance. Now, it's a particular pleasure to introduce the speakers, but the first question I want to start with, before I say something a little bit about Meghna Desai, I want to just raise the question. Is that better? I want to raise the question, the punchline's gone now, so the jokes were in. Who is he? Now, to answer the question, who is Meghna, you could give a lecture on the philosophy of identity and then draw some conclusions and see whether they match up. But I want to just recount a simpler story that took place, an incident that took place some months ago when I was walking down Houghton Street with my son, who was then just 13. We were coming down Houghton Street, and Meghna was standing at the main entrance to the LSE talking to Tony Giddens. And I said to my son, well, you're now going to meet your first lord. And he looked down the street and he said, where? So, you know, I pointed out Lord Meghna Desai. And he said, that's not a lord. So, this was a bit surprising. So I said to him, well, I think it is the lord, you know. He said, I don't think so, Dad. I said, well, how would you know when you recognized the lord and how you didn't? So another question, you know, about identity and so on. He said, no, Dad, that's not a lord. That's someone else. That's not a lord. That's a boxing promoter. That's Don King. So we got up to Meghnad, and I said to Meghnad, my son thinks, and my son then, of course, was beginning to kick me. Don't embarrass me, Dad. He kicked me and said, I said, my son thinks you look like Don King. And Meghnad said, that's absolutely right. And it's to my great advantage when I visit New York City, when people actually think I am this person, and I often get a red carpet treatment when I otherwise wouldn't have done so. So we welcome this evening a Don King lookalike in the form of Lord Meghna Desai. Now, Meghna Desai has been at the LSE for a long time. Some people simply refer to him as the grandfather of the LSE. But as I recall, his appointment here was in the early 60s, or was it the mid-60s when you came. He was elevated to the House of Lords in the early 90s, in 1991, which makes him, of course, an old Labour peer. So it's good to know that you were appointed in those days, and represent a tradition now fast diminishing. And he's about to publish yet another work, I think it's early next year, called Marx's Revenge. And I don't know whether, is that the title, Meghna? Yes, correctly informed. And I don't know whether he'll speak to some of those themes this evening. But I certainly look forward to it. I think you might want to sit there.
I think that place is very noisy. If you could all come forward. Come forward, because the air conditioning makes that bit very noisy. So do come forward.
I'm going to speak from here.
To the front.
I'm going to
plenty of seats in the front.
We'll use these mics. Is that better? Okay. We'll sit down and use these mics. Well, I'm not going to repeat the introduction. So I'm just going to welcome our first speaker, Meghna Desai, and also welcome our second speaker. We actually have two this evening. Yahid Syed, who's a research officer at the Center for Global Governance. And he's also going to speak for a few moments after Meghnad. His main interests are the anti-capitalist movements and Russia. So two speakers, Meghnad, who's going to talk something, develop an account of the history of the anti-capitalist movements, and then our second speaker is going to say something about the nature of those movements and their status now. So thanks very much and welcome.
Thank you. Maybe I'll just use this rather than stand up. If I cannot be heard, please let me know. Now, I think in a sense, anti-capitalist movements are as old as capitalism, because wherever there has been capitalism, there has been anti-capitalism. We are particularly focusing this evening on anti-capitalist movements because in the 1990s, especially in late 1990s, there began to be a upsurge, a network of movements, which are, some of them were in developed countries, some of them developing countries, which in a sense became a coalition of people who didn't like a lot of the transformations which were going on, which all come under the rubric of globalization. Now, in a sense, we could call them anti-globalization movement, but you know, people are saying, what does globalization really mean? Well, globalization is capitalism. Much simpler to think of globalization as capitalism. And it is capitalism in a recent phase, a new phase of capitalism, a developed phase of capitalism, in which it is global in its reach, because the Cold War has finished. And for first, it's global in its reach. And because the financial markets, which are going to be a central part of our story, because the financial markets deregulated and grew very rapidly in the 80s and 1990s, it's very much a phase of capitalism which mirrors the way capitalism was before the First World War. Before the First World War, capitalism was a global phenomenon. There were imperial powers and colonies and so on. But there was a very free movement of capital, and indeed even a very free movement of labor. At that time, there was international gold standard, and all currencies were convertible, and people and money could move across the globes. And also at that time, people did not have the perception that the nation state or the state would look after its citizens, or that the state would control the economy. So in those days, the anti-capitalist movement was also internationalist. In one way, it was internationalist, the Socialist International, which Marx founded in 1864, and then it was refounded in 1889. That was a coalition of working class parties across Europe, across mainly Western Europe, and also there were working class movements in the USA. Now, those people had a view of capitalism as international or global, because it was a fact. And they organized against capital in a variety of ways. They had a programmatic view of capitalism. There was also another movement, which was nationalism. Nationalism was a very powerful movement, especially in what one called the periphery of empires. Remember, after all, the First World War was started by what we nowadays call a terrorist, shooting down Archduke Ferdinand of Austria, and he was a Serb. And this all started in the Balkans. Now, so, and I could go on to earlier movements against capitalism, which started in late 18th century and so on. The Luddites in the 19th century were an anti-capitalist movement, and so on. Now, what is peculiar about this phase of anti-capitalist movement? On the one hand, it is quite modern. It's very sort of flexible, not very hierarchical. It's a network of NGOs or independent movements. It's very, very hip on technology, so it uses internet and you know, websites and mobile telephones and whatever else it is. So it is very much using the modern technology to build up a kind of a global coalition. And it is against certain sort of features of late 20th century capitalism. Now, what are those features of late 20th century capitalism? One, quite centrally, is financial markets. The fact that financial markets have been built on deregulated capital movements, the fact that many more countries have stock markets which did not have them before, fact that there is foreign exchange dealings daily, around the clock, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, around the world, lots and lots of different stock markets and so on. And the fact that, very often cited fact, that today the daily volume of transactions on foreign exchange markets is $1 trillion, $1,000 billion a daily transaction. All those things make this phase of globalization almost distinctly marked by the financial power of what I call markets. So when people say markets don't like something, it are mainly financial markets. And those financial markets are first of all seen by many people as constraining the nation state from following progressive policies, running budget deficits or trying to spend money in certain ways which may be thought to be unorthodox. So on the one hand, financial markets are seen to be eroding the sovereignty of the nation state. And secondly, they are also thought to be, in a sense, mysterious, unaccountable, invisible, because, who are the financial markets? Well, there are thousands and thousands of young stockbrokers or people operating on the machines, buying and selling day after day. And it becomes like an invisible, powerful force, and people don't like that. But one of those features of global financial market. Secondly, I think has been very importantly the liberalization, or the whole philosophy of liberal economic policy. Much of the period in between 1914 and sort of 1990, think about it. Capitalism had a very different form. In those years, the nation state was very powerful. People thought nation state ran economies. You know, it could control economies. The nation state was as it were the big player in shaping economy. And capitalist or communist economies, by and large, gave the state a very prominent role in regulating economic life. And what the state did, and the whole philosophy of economics in those days, was built on what we'd call a mixed economy, a combination of state and market, with the state playing a leading role, or what one might call in economic jargon, is based on the notion of market failure, that markets did not always work, and the state had to play a prominent part, correcting the failures of the market, and the state had to play a leading role in development, planning. Planning was very popular, and so on. And countries differed only in the degree of mixture between state and market, but there's nothing purely liberal like was in the 19th century. And in the last 25 years of the 20th century, there began a reaction against this. People thought that because of a hyperinflation and stagflation, somehow all that philosophy had failed. That kind of economics, what is called Keynesian economics broadly, had failed. And we needed to go away from the state and rely more on market-oriented policies. And along with the deregulation of capital markets, which is a very important part of this, came the idea that markets in all spheres ought to be the major determinants of allocation of resources. Therefore, what's called liberal economic policies, or the Washington Consensus, is that countries ought to have balanced budgets, stable monetary policy, countering inflation. They should actually not have state play a major role in production, should not have any nationalization. If there are publicly owned enterprises, they should be privatized. Incentives should be offered for private sector to come in. Markets should be open to foreign capital, etc., etc. This whole package of liberal economic policy is another bone of contention. And third part of that, this all kind of in the same logic, third part is the growth of foreign trade. Again, in one of the very fundamental belief in the middle period, 1940-1989, was somehow that countries had a right to have tariff protection, that free movement of goods in and out of the country was not always the advantage of a country, and that countries had to have either import quotas or tariffs or export subsidies. Somehow, countries had to manage their foreign trade and not leave it unmanaged. And again, another sort of trend which grew very much after the Second World War, but really accelerated in the 1980s, was the idea that instead of having all these tariffs and quotas, countries ought to liberalize the trade as much as possible, remove tariffs against each other's trade, and therefore that will lead to mutual benefit. And the end of this process would be free trade. We are zillions of miles away from free trade, but at least what I would call freer trade. And that is embodied in one institution. You know, the deregulated capital markets are not embodied in any institution. They are amorphous. The liberal economic philosophy, as I said, was the Washington Consensus. That is because both IMF and World Bank are in Washington. But this freer trade is embodied in the WTO, the World Trade Organization. And the World Trade Organization emerged because in the 1980s, many developing countries, which had just industrialized, began to agitate for greater access to markets of developed countries. And what used to be called the General Agreement of Trade and Tariff, GATT, expanded much more in scope and in membership. And in Marrakesh in 1994, a big treaty was signed, which gave rise to WTO. Now, WTO, because it embodies a liberalizing trade philosophy, i.e., if you join WTO, you have to dismantle your tariffs, you dismantle your quota barriers, you have to sort of move to a freer trade. People feel that that is really one of the big villains of globalization. These three aspects completely deny and go against the logic of the middle phase of capitalism, which was what I would call capitalism in one country. In different countries, like capitalism in one country, each country thought it could have its own capitalism, shape it as it liked. Some people call that capitalism socialism, but that's another problem I won't go into. But that's it. And because it is like that, somehow citizens feel that their government is no longer in control of their economy. Now, this may be a good thing or a bad thing. Some people think it's a good thing governments are not in control of the economy, but most people feel that unaccountable forces are running their lives. And so one of the forces which is powering the anti-capitalist movement is the feeling that somehow one ought to be able to go back to the days when the state was in control, and you know, so the state could look after citizens and things like that. As I was saying, this belief was not there in 19th century at all. It's purely a belief local to 20th century, and it's not based on any eternal verity. It's just a fashionable theory. Now, one important part of the anti-capitalist movement is that although some of it is very modern, some of it is very, very old. And one of the oldest part of the anti-capitalist movement is its mistrust of money. Mistrust of money and credit is a very old part of the human psyche. You know, in Islam, for example, there is prohibition on usury, lending money as an interest. In medieval Christianity, there was the same sort of suspicion of money. Aristotle laid down the doctrine that money was barren, and therefore money could not yield any fruit. And if you charged interest on money, you were doing something unnatural. I mean, I happen to think it's wrong economics, but we'll leave that aside for time. That's a very deep feeling that somehow money and monetary relations poison life, and that they somehow, if you could only remove the influence of money, life would become better again. People somehow also think, which happens to be a fallacy, that in the old days money was not as important as it is now, and therefore somehow we could go back to the old days. Now, these are very, very strongly held views, but they happen to be, in my view, not correct. But I'll just say one. I'll give a nice example of it, which is slightly counterintuitive, and don't think the story will take very long. In the Gospels, there is this famous story of Christ throwing money changers out of the temple, which you all, being good Bible readers, would know. Christ goes into the temple and throws the money changers out, and that's thought to be a good thing. Now, you know, what were the money changers doing in the temple, you ask yourself? You know, why were the money in the temple? Of course, in all these temples, are very big thing. There are shops in the temple, and it kind of be like supermarkets, you know, with some religious niche in it. Now, in the big temple in Jerusalem, the temple only accepted temple coins as offering. So if you had come from Samaria or Judea or Abyssinia or wherever else, you brought your own little currency. And you had to change your currency for temple currency before you could offer it. So basically, those money changers were performing a very useful financial service. They're helping the devout practice their devotion. The problem was not the money changes. The problem was that the temple had a monopoly of what it accepted. The real problem here is not the competition of money changes, but the monopoly of the temple. And if Christ had clearly seen it, he would have waged a war against the monopoly of the temple. Why wouldn't the temple accept anybody's currency? What's wrong with people's currency? What's going on here? You know, is my money not good as anybody else's money? So as usual, he got the wrong thing, but at least he got into the newspapers. So, people have a great difficulty understanding services of any kind because they're invisible. There's no product there. And people have great suspicion of financial services because they think somehow charging interest is bad, and because if you have a debt and you have to pay interest, if you can't pay interest, the debt just goes on increasing. And people say, why have I, I only borrowed £1,000, why am I paying back, more and more, The less you pay, the more you have to pay by then, Some of you are too young to have a mortgage, but when you have a mortgage, you realize. Anyway, this cluster of belief, first of all, there's a very strong belief against financial markets and financial people feel manipulated and so on. Secondly, because financial markets have this principle of sort of libertarian or free movement, they combine with liberal economic philosophy, and that's good. Now, other aspects come into this, and one of them is environmental aspect, which is nothing whatever to do with the liberal philosophy as such, because environmental critique of economic growth was a part of economics or political movements, even when the state was very powerful and Keynesianism was being practiced and so on. And the fact that governments ruin the environment has been known for ages, and the market comes later onto the scene of that. But the anti-environment, so people who want to protect the environment, people who are worried about biodiversity, combined with people who are worried about now, one more thing I should add to it, which kind of gives the whole anti-capitalist movement a very different flavor. And that is that we're not really strictly a single world economy yet. The world is not really fully globalized. So on the one hand, there are these markets, which are by and large, same all over the world, buying and selling bonds or shares or exchanges, whatever it is. But the real kind of going across that market is what I would call the interstate system. The power relations between nation states. And the power relation between nation states is, of course, very unequal. There are some powerful rich countries and lots of poor countries. Some of those power relations also are historically shaped by imperialism, things like that. But on one hand, the state system is very unequal, but it's frustratingly based on the principle of equality. So in the United Nations, every member in every United Nations, a member country has a single vote, at least in the General Assembly, Security Council. Now, what I think goes on is that when it comes to negotiating further liberalization or the implementation of a liberal economic philosophy or even deregulation of markets, the inequality of power relations in the interstate system take the lead role in shaping how the market spreads. So if the market was spreading just like a market and the state played no role, one would not complain about it. But what really happens is that even the spread of global market is filtered through the unequal interstate system. So for example, the deregulated capital markets first began with USA and UK. And then US and UK more or less, their progress and difference in a change in philosophy meant that all the OECD countries had to willy-nilly get on to a liberal capital market thing. And then later on, when Eastern Europe went into transition, they quickly had to transition to that. So some of the spread of the market is not because of natural efficiency of the market compared to the state, but because the interstate power system has dictated or done that. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there are no other power foci left to counter this. So while the Soviet Union was there, in its economic, it was a pretty ghastly mess. But at least it for many countries, it was the alternative to capitalism. Now there are no alternatives to capitalism left, and the interstate's power system has become even more unequal than it was before. So some of the resentment of globalization are against the interstate power system. And they're seen as a, and so again, one could say, I just thought about it, that you could say, well, there is capitalism, there's globalization. Globalization is capitalism plus the interstate system. And that is what makes a difference. If you did not have the interstate system, one would be, the world would still be unequal, but at least it would not be accompanied by the inequality of the military power and such other things. So a lot of international institutions are run not on a democratic basis. They are run on a basis of inequality. In the Security Council, the 5 permanent members are very powerful. In IMF and World Bank, the rich countries control most of the votes. Only in the WTO, there is one country, one vote. But then nobody likes the WTO, but that's a mystery. So the anti-capitalist movement is a cluster of movements, mainly against this triad of financial arena, the financial deregulation, liberal economic philosophy, and freer trade. And some people in the network, some people are clear, and I think Yahya Said will talk more about than I do. Some people are basically totally and completely opposed to capitalism as such. They just don't like any of this, either because they're religious fundamentalists or they're communists or whatever it is, anarchists. They just don't like. They don't like markets. They don't like the state. They just don't like any of this. They reject even sort of modernity. Then there are people who are say, well, it's not bad, but let's go back to the single state capitalism, which was a nice, happy thing we had in the 50s and 60s, and let the state come back into control. Let's Keynesian economic rule again or something like that. And then, of course, there are people who say, well, now, come on, the horse had fled from the stable and all that, but we can still control the horse. So let us tame the system, let's reform it, tame it, and shape it in such a way that it would be for the benefit of the majority of people in the world. For example, the system could be better towards the poor and so on. Now, in a sense, that's always been a part of problem of capitalism, that while it generates prosperity, it doesn't always guarantee good distribution. And it didn't guarantee good distribution when there were nation states were powerful, but at least people sort of thought they had political control over distribution. So what we have here is a variety of attitudes about what the central problem of globalization, as well as a variety of perspectives from which people come to oppose globalization. And that is the power of the system. A movement based on a single ideology and single party doesn't actually last very long. I mean, quite surprisingly, the Leninist Communist Party lasted very, very long. But by and large, those things don't. What really gives strength to the anti-globalization movement is its amorphous nature. Different people can bring different. And I think, by and large, although I don't agree with it, I think it's been a very healthy thing. It's been a very, very healthy thing. And the fact that the G7 get excited about it and complain proves that it's a very good thing. And the fact that all the leaders of the world don't like it. Who elected them anyway to be world leaders? Their countries may have elected them, but nobody elected them to lead the world. Anyway, but I think one of the most healthiest thing has been that the nature of our current economy, the nature of political system, what countries or corporations do, what decisions they make, how they may affect people's lives, I think is understood much better today than it was understood 30, 35 years ago. And in the good old days of the nation state, there was not this clear understanding of how economics can affect people's lives, how those decisions have really far-reaching impact, how things are kind of intermeshed and have these consequences, both short-term and long-run. Just think about the ecological problems. Now, that kind of understanding has come very, very recently. And I think it's been one of the most healthiest things, because even as in some people may say, well, these are fallacies, and I may not like what they do. The fact that now, by the use of a variety of different mediums, people understand or talk or participate in saying something about the economy. And the economy is, while it is quite opaque and quite impersonal, at least people are trying to personalize it through global corporations or governments or organizations like WTO and think, let's do something about it. And in a sense, in a very, very long perspective, longer than, I would like, I think this would be the beginning of some kind of a global political society we are forming a global civil society, which is kind of the theme of these lectures. I'm kind of old-fashioned, crude Marxist. And therefore, I feel, first of all, there'll be a global economy, then there'll be a global state. You know, that's the way it is going to be. There's no other path in the world, and that's the only theory that I believe in. So I think global civil society is being formed. It's right now very thin across the world. But what is forming it is the fact that this interplay of global economic forces, movement of capital and so on, is bringing people together willy-nilly. You know, people don't want to get into the relationships together, but, you know, basically the mode by which we get our living defines the social relations of production, as someone famous once said. And basically, globalization is making us come together, like it or not. And in that, the consciousness that there is a common interest of people across the world, you know, and it has got only a half false consciousness, as it were, I think it's very powerful, very powerful. And I think eventually when, for example, the United Nations are reformed, for which one can only wait, make the United Nations more democratic, for example, the change will come because people have seen that what the United Nations does is no longer just a technical problem. What the IMF does is no longer just a technical problem. You know, what happens over rules on derivative markets or debt settlement are things which affect people's lives. So in a sense, the nice thing about anti-capitalist movements are that they're demystifying some of this stuff. And I don't think they're going to change the world in any radical way. I mean, it's not going to be that, you know, capitalism is going to collapse or anything like that. But I think it is going to improve the interstate system and the way the interstate system impinges on the market. So it's not so much going to be displace the market, but actually it's going to improve the interstate system. And there are varieties of strategies for that, which I think Yaya will talk more about it now. But my basic, I actually believe globalization is the finest thing which ever happened. And it'll go on like this, and it's going to bring tremendous, tremendous gains to the poor of the world. I haven't actually talked about all that. But the fact that people don't think that is by itself a very creative tension in the world today. I think through that creative tension, we're going to get a better version of globalization progressively. Thank you.
Thanks, Meghnad. Actually, before I start, I would like to pick up on the last point you made, which is the fact that globalization is a very good thing and is going to be bringing tremendous benefits to everyone. I think a large contingent of the so-called anti-globalization movement actually believe that too. Their problem is that while more and more people are moving out of poverty, while on average everybody is better off through globalization, there are pockets or certain parts of society where poverty and exclusion and powerlessness has reached new heights. In a way, the system of capitalism in one country, while inhibited growth or development kind of at the global scale, it also put a bottom under the social ladder. The system of capitalism in one country, while inhibited kind of overall growth and creativity, or kind of slowed it down, it kind of put a bottom under the social framework. Anyway, but I'll probably get back to that in the coming sections. My talk will be very short, and I'll talk about two things. First of all, I will talk about four myths that are usually associated with the anti-capitalist movement. And the second thing, I will talk about briefly about its prospects after the events of September 11. One widespread myth about the anti-capitalist movement, it consists of white kids speaking on behalf of poor southerners without actually knowing what they're talking about, and somehow in the process actually damaging the interests of the southerners. This is not entirely truth. At any point in time, there is more anti-capitalist protests in the South than there is in the North, between Seattle of 99 and Genoa of this year, there were dozens of anti-capitalist protests or protests of an anti-capitalist nature in the third world, whether it's about the privatization of utilities in Bolivia or IMF programs in Turkey or Argentina or protests against Shell in Nigeria or Enron in India. Two, many of the ideas, rhetoric, methods of action that are characteristic for the anti-capitalist movement actually come from the South. A particular influence is the Zapatista movement in Chiapas in Mexico. Naomi Klein, who is one of the kind of spokespeople about for this anti-capitalist movement, says the following about the Chiapas. I may never have made the pilgrimage to Chiapas, but I have watched the Zapatistas' ideas spread through activist circles, passed along second and third hand, a phrase, a way to run a meeting, a metaphor that twists your brain around. Unlike classic revolutionaries who preach through bullhorns and from pulpits, Marcos has spread the Zapatista word through riddles, revolutionaries who don't want power, people who must hide their faces to be seen, a world with many worlds in it, a movement of one no and many yeses. Third, the white kids demonstrating in Seattle and Genoa and Prague and Washington are actually acting on their own behalf as much as they are doing so in solidarity with the Southerners. One of the main common denominators of the anti-capitalist movement is a feeling of being left behind, a feeling of exclusion. And this applies to people from the north rejecting the tyranny of brands, in their words, or to landless peasants actually fighting for their survival in the south. Exclusion is a common denominator. It has many forms. Poverty is only one of them. Meghna touched on the other one, which is a feeling of powerlessness, a feeling of being unable to influence one's own fate, a feeling that traditional methods of influencing politics through elections, through talking to your MPs, doesn't work anymore because your MPs and your government has much less power today. The second myth I'm going to talk about is that it's a negative movement. It is often said that we know what you stand against, but what do you stand for? Well, if you look and if you've, that was basically part of the conclusion that Meghnad said, if you look at the movement over the last 10 years of its existence, or even actually less than 10 years, it has achieved political feats. It has achieved feats that professional politicians can only dream of. One, it engaged and mobilized people who were for a very long time on the margins of political process. And two, it has injected issues into the political discourse which politicians and policymakers would have rather ignored or papered over. I mean, no matter what the Gordon Brown wants you to believe, but debt forgiveness, for example, would have never happened if not for Seattle. And the opening of the international financial institutions or the compromises that were reached at the WTO meeting at Doha are all, at least in part, thanks to the pressure that was exerted by the anti-capitalist movement. So it's not that negative of a movement after all. Three. The third myth is that there's nothing new about it and it's actually old tired slogan. Well, this is actually partly true, and Meghnad touched upon this extensively. The issues that the anti-capitalist movement raises are as old as capitalism itself. What are the boundaries of the market? How are they determined and enforced? And two, can markets be trusted to produce stable and just outcomes, or does it require some sort of external intervention? But there are several new twists to this, and again, Meghnad touched on some of them. One of them is the target of the movement. Old anti-capitalist movements were focused on the state. The goal was either to capture the state, or to reform it, or to do away with it altogether. The current movement is shifting its focus. While it's still targeting the stronger states, the G7, the United States, in most other instances, the target of the new movement is the corporation itself. Second, group, part of novelty of the current movement is the unprecedented coalition of post-communists, reformers, unionists, anarchists, feminists, environmentalists, you name it. I mean, if you go to any of these events, of the anti-capitalist events, you would be bewildered at the array of groups involved. And finally, the methods that, that they employ and their use of technology and pop culture, which is kind of qualitatively different, which have succeeded in lending the, this movement its mass appeal. The fourth myth is that this is a movement, I want to talk about, is that this is a movement against globalization. As Meghnad outlined before, there are actually many streams in this movement. There are many groups, and only one of them, which is by far the least popular, is truly anti-globalization. And these are the isolationists, the fundamentalists, those people who are rejecting rejecting kind of modern capitalism, and they're looking forward either to some sort of autarkic nation-state solutions, something like, you know, the Taliban regime in Afghanistan or Yugoslavia, or to just stay in the wilderness, basically. But the other parts of the movements, which are mostly reformist of nature, are actually embracing globalization. They are, what they are trying to do is to reform it, to give it a human face. A very important stream in the movement, which is kind of the main driving force behind the riots and the events in Seattle and Genoa, are the alternatives. And these are people who do not necessarily have an agenda. They don't necessarily have an alternative or an answer. But they want to create space. They're obsessed with kind of claiming things back, and they do that symbolically and in fact. They try to create, you know, they reclaim the street, or they reclaim a, they try a venue or a mall. And these are the people who have most creatively employed pop culture and technology to give the movement its appeal and its widespread popularity. Finally, I would like to say a couple of words about the future of the movement after September 11. Since we started writing this chapter, actually, a year and a half ago, the reaction to the anti-capitalist movement has evolved from ridicule to an acknowledgement and even support in many mainstream circles. But things have changed since September 11, and there are lots of questions about the movement. Should opposition to capitalism and globalization be forfeited for the sake of unity and the fight against terror? Is global capitalism the cause or the cure of terror? There is obviously some, I think, disarray in, this, in the anti-capitalist movement as to what to do next. The attempt to transform the anti-capitalist protests planned for the IMF meetings, which were going to happen immediately after the 11th of September, to transform them into a peace protest, were not very successful. Not many people showed up. It wasn't very successful. Here, the marriage between the peace movement and the anti-capitalist movement in London was much more successful. Their last demonstration attracted what some people estimate at 20,000 people. But their main arguments are the following: why the anti-capitalist movement is more relevant today than it was ever. First, that capitalism is actually part of the problem, or global capitalism. It creates what I spoke before in terms of exclusion, and exclusion breeds frustration and violence. It does so both in the slums of Gaza or in Islamic immigrant communities in Europe and the US. Two, collapsing states and economies in the aftermath of structural adjustment or state mismanagement creates these large swaths of badlands where criminal networks operate and spread globally and provide a bloodline for global terrorism. Third, public spending cuts, privatization, deregulation weaken public services, including healthcare and security, in developed countries and create openings for terrorists to inflict more damage. So today, basically, under the pretext of the war on terrorism, there is an attempt to kind of silence the movement, to kind of say that, well, this is not the time, it's time now to kind of stick together in the fight against terrorism. And this is unfortunately not correct, because one of the few viable alternatives to global terrorism is global civil society, and the anti-capitalist movement is an integral part of that. Thank you.
We have a 20 minutes, half an hour to explore some questions. May I suggest we take them in clusters so that you don't just sit there and there's another question and another lecture. But why don't we take four or five questions to begin with? There are roaming mics at the back, which can come to you. So if you'd like to raise a question, please do so. Keep it as a question rather than a statement. And just raise your hand and a microphone will appear.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much. Yeah, I'd like to just raise a query now about the whole notion of a global civil society. Now, Magdad, you said that you're skeptical in a way, too, about global civil society, but it is being formed. Now, if you're going to say that anti-capitalist movements constitute a global civil society, I don't think that goes through, does it? Because anti-capitalist movements are protest movements, which is a kind of a negative version of a global civil society. But for a global civil society to actually mean something substantive, it has to be rather more positive than just protest movements. Thinking of the idea of civil society, back to Hegel and so on and so forth.
Thank you. Let's take some more. Second question here. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like both of you to elaborate a little on right-wing anti-globalization movements. I'm thinking about parties like Jörg Haiders in Austria and the Danish People's Party in Denmark, for instance.
Let's have some more. Time to wake up. That's two. Do I hear three? Excellent. Sold a gentleman over there.
Yes, both speakers were relatively optimistic as regards the future of the anti-of the movement, we'll just call it. So, Magnad, you even predicted at some point the emergence of a global government.
Can you put the mic closer to your mouth? Thanks.
Sorry.
That's great.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Right. How do you reconcile that with the fact that the established political that the political establishment is being, that people feel disenfranchised by the political establishment, that less people are voting all across the world. And that means that they have no concrete power base from which to actually counter these globalization phenomena. My question is, how do you see the intermediate solution with people who have no actual power? How are they going to be able to change things where people have vested interests?
Thank you very much. Fourth question. I'm determined to get to five. Anybody else who would like to ask something now? I'll have to ask two questions to get to five.
No. You succeeded.
Very good.
And right. Question
and another one here in a moment. Thank you.
This is for the previous speaker. You said that the civil society, the emergence of society, isn't entirely negative, it's very positive. I do understand there are specific cases like where they are being positive, perhaps, like support fair trade coffee, let's have deprecateness, blah, blah, blah. But those are all individual cases. They're not alternative paradigms almost. So it's safe to say that the emergence of civil society basically accepts the big global capitalist paradigm and just wants amendments onto it? Or is there actually a true alternative paradigm that they're trying to promote, as opposed to these ad hoc pieces here and there?
Good question. Clear question, thank you. And down here? Did you raise your pen? You did?
Hello. Basically I was just wondering on the principle of the WTA as a major driver of capitalism, in what way could you suggest either reformation or improvements or indeed disbanding that to redistribute the wealth away from the triadization that we understand globalization to be.
Thank you. That's starters for five.
Okay. Shall I begin?
And then we'll have another round, so work on it.
Yes, I don't actually say that a global civil society is identical to the anti-capitalist movement. That would be very, very, very narrow, fair to say. I think a global civil society is emerging across a variety of things. There are lots and lots of NGOs and international NGOs, and there are trade associations. You know, I mean, for example, there are as many associations of manufacturers and financial services and so on, which all would be part of a global civil society, especially in the original Hegelian sense, because at that time civil society was the market in Adam Ferguson. And so basically we today very much exclude the economic sphere from global civil society. But then you have to say, well, yeah, there's a global economy, there's a global civil society. But I think anti-capitalist movement is a very small part of the global civil society, but it is not all of it. I think what global civil society is, as you'll see in this book, there is an inventory of how many NGOs are there, how many topics they span, and the anti-capitalist movement is the most visible part of it, but I think there is much more to it. There's a variety of gender, green movements, political movements, and So I don't accept the premise that this is, I'm arguing that it's identical. I mean, in a sense, if you know, the previous lectures have gone over the various aspects of global civil society, and John Keane was about definitions and so on. And I think this has just started. Global civil society has just begun, or rather re-begun after the hiatus of a, you know, the short 20th century was a little diversion from the march of history. These things happen. And if you forget the short 20th century, we can resume progress. And I think, in a sense, this is the way, for example, we still even haven't got the kind of labor mobility which was there in the 19th century. You know, in the 19th century, one-third of the population of Europe, one-third moved across to North America. Think of that. And transformed the geography, the economic geography of the Western world. Now today, we are in our great nation states, in trying to protect our rich standards of living, is trying to deny people from coming here, call them asylum seekers and economic refugees and all sorts of things. We put incredible obstacles in their way. I mean, if you really believed in distribution of wealth, really the distribution of wealth, we would throw open our doors for anybody to come here. And you know, our incomes are 20 times their incomes. Why shouldn't they come over here and compete with us? Of course, we're not going to do that, because we love our high standards of living. And part of the Seattle protest was exactly like that. You know, some of the opposition to trade is really protectionist, because we don't want the Chinese to take our jobs away. And why not? You know, the Chinese work harder than us, and if they're more efficient, so should they. This is why I believe in the market. I actually genuinely believe that the globalization and more liberal trade is the best hope poor countries have ever of getting out of poverty. And I passionately believe that. And the way developed countries have put incredible number of obstacles in the way of more liberal trade, no matter what they say, they have put incredible number of obstacles. They close their market, they subsidize their agriculture, they don't let the textiles of developing countries come in, textiles, leather, every time. And they do that because they know that their prosperity has been built on certain false premises. If real competition took place, you know, we would have some much greater equality in the world. But of course, don't worry, it's not going to happen. Progressive forces will see to it that no such thing will happen. By God, progressive forces are very powerful. And rich countries will use poverty, environment, any excuse to hang on to the gains and not. Anyway, that's another thing. Now, a very interesting question about the right-wing anti-capitalist movement. You know, in the anti-capitalist movements throughout last 200-300 years, there has always been a right-wing element. You know, the idea that anti-capitalism is left-wing is very, very recent throughout. I mean, in a sense, originally when capitalism as a burst on the scene, you can choose your century, 16th, 17th, 18th, there was an opposition, first of all, because the really old bastions of power, the landlords, you know, the status hierarchies, were smashed by capitalism. And people didn't like the vulgar merchants making money and, you know, and dirtying the portals of power. And for example, in the British Conservative Party, if you look at a career of somebody like the Marquess of Salisbury, who was Prime Minister four times in the 19th century, there was always a very anti-capitalist ethos to Salisbury and Disraeli, whereas Robert Peel, who split the party on anti-corn law agitation, was as it were Whig and liberal. So in a sense, there is an anti-capitalist right-wing movement. What I think drives Jorge Haider and people like that is basically the fact that the initial impact of globalization, and especially Austria and Germany, of liberalization of sort of migration, people coming in from Poland and Hungary and you know, where does it fall? The impact, you know, one of the reasons why free immigration is difficult is the impact of immigration falls, to begin with, on the lowest paid jobs. Because that is where the migrants come in. And the resentment, you know, it's basically, while eventually migration benefits the receiving country, it takes a very long time. The transition process is very often the impact is suffered by people who are the lowest paid people, because that's where the competition goes. That's where that's, you know, if relatively unskilled migrant labor, that's where it goes in. And so the resentment is first created against the migrants among the lower paid people. And right-wing parties have all been very efficient at exploiting that cut among the working class, among the lower middle classes. And so there is a sort of reality. And what's very interesting, quite a lot of people who are enthusiastic for enlargement of the EU haven't really faced up to this question, that when enlargement takes place, there's going to be a tremendous shock to labor markets in Western Europe. And we haven't really thought through. And of course, the thing is not to stop immigration, but to take countermeasures which you can to, as it were, manage a transition. It can be done, isn't it? Nothing mysterious about it. So anyway, that's a... No, I think... Briefly. I think, you know, if you think that democracy takes place to people voting in parliament, electing MPs, and MPs and representative interests and all that, that's not the way politics takes place at all. That is kind of the myth of politics. When the poor want something, they riot. And that's how they get things. You know, the slow process is much too slow. I know we celebrate and we like it, and I'm going to spend the rest of the evening, my next 6 hours, on the benches, to try and amend the law. But eventually, historically, how have the poor got anything? By struggle. By often violent struggles, riot strikes. And, you know, as Yaya was saying, had it not been for the riot in Seattle, nobody would have taken any of this stuff seriously. You can go petition your MP forever, but, your MP is not going to do anything. What are you going to do? You just go spectacular riot, and it works. Violence works. So I think what is going on here is we are trying to form alternative ways of global representation, which are not classically in terms of elections and voting and so on. That may come eventually. When the system settles down, that'll come. But just as the growth of democracy in Western Europe came more because of agitation by working class radical parties and women, if you read the history of women's suffrage movement in this country, it is the most violent movement going. No other movement has been as violent as women's suffrage movement in this country since. I mean, you must read it. The idea that all this happens in a nice la-di-da way. So I think I like it because it is a whole new form of association. And, writing your MPs will never get you anywhere.
Well, I've been left with the last two questions.
No, you can answer any question.
And go closer to the mic.
There was a question about the negative nature of the anti-capitalist movement. This is a good question because, well, first of all, there are elements of it who do have an alternative program, and thus include those who reject capitalism and who want to go back to some sort of a nation-state-based development model go back to I don't know, national liberation states or right-wing autarkic states or whatever. So in a way, in terms of kind of offering an alternative agenda, there are alternative agendas, not necessarily the best. But what I meant by the movement being positive is that despite the fact that it is a protest movement, it has led to some positive results by empowering people, by getting them engaged in the political process, by opening up all these black boxes of the WTO and the IMF and international financial market regulations and trade regulations. Is this enough, or is there a need for more kind of detailed and constructive proposals? Yes, and there's this whole wing of the movement, which is the reformists, which are not necessarily the most active rioters, who are actually using the space created by the protests and by the riots and all these things to influence policymakers, both at the national and international level. Finally, what to do with the WTO? I think that would have been a question for Meghnad, but...
We'll ask him in a minute. We'll ask you in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll just take a few more questions. It'd be good to finish at 7:30, but perhaps there are one or two more questions. Well, let's see if somebody else wants to ask who hasn't asked. Yes, please.
I agree that if you're going to try and better capitalism or globalization, that the thing to do, in my view, is through liberalization and free trade. It's a good answer. I think one of the things I see in the world is how do you get the goodwill for that to take place? If you look at what happened recently in Doha, going into it, all the media was about the developing world has to get in behind the sort of terrorism thing and make sure halt those negotiations. No one was saying, well, the French have to liberalize agriculture. And the agreement came up with very fudge language on agriculture and some very good things for the developing countries, especially the amount of times the word developing country comes up in that document. But what I'm trying to look for is what is going to be the trigger that will give us that goodwill. And I thought maybe September 11th. It's kind of the sorts of things I'm thinking of is when will the developed world work out that the developing world's problems are its problems too? September 11 is one, terrorism. The other thing is things like refugees. You'd have Australia shipping boats off everywhere to try and get rid of them. But it doesn't really seem to be changing. And in your view, what is there a trigger and what's it going to be?
Thank you very much. Anyone else who hasn't asked a question?
Hi. You compared the possible emergence of world governance to the emergence of nation states following on the emergence of an economy. Do you think that means that governance is going to emerge as a system to defend the inequalities in that economy, or is there some other route that a world governance can follow in contrast to the way nation states emerged?
Thank you. Can we climb to 3? Oh, thank you very much.
Just a quick one. How do you see the future of the apparent democracies that we have in the West developing with globalization?
Fourth? I've got a question, but I'll only tag it on if I'm allowed by silence. You want to come back? Okay, just you and then me, and then we'll stop.
Thanks a lot. Thanks very much. I have a different question, actually. Both speakers appear to want to say that globalization is not intricately connected with capitalism. In other words, there could be some sort of globalized system of governance, not capitalism.
You can finish your question.
It seems that capitalism is absolutely integral to the driving force of globalization.
Okay, now here's my question. One question, actually it's two. The first one, just to spoil the sense that there may be a consensus on this panel, I just wonder whether the two speakers think they agree with each other about the way they've characterized economic globalization. Because Meghnad Desai seems to me to have painted an essentially benign view of that process. The problem of economic globalization is politics. That's a very familiar line of argument, part of the process of neoliberal deregulation we were talking about earlier. The obstacles are the interstate system, caesara, and the problem is that the geopolitical interests embedded in that system. Our second speaker seemed to me to be suggesting that economic globalization and exclusion may be two sides of the same coin. And in fact, the evidence on global inequality shows it's a contested area, but as I understand it, that not only are relative inequalities exploding over the last 30 years, but the the evidence for trickle-down at all to the world's poorest is at least in question. Certainly Robert Wade from the LSE has raised these issues recently in articles from The Economist, which The Economist didn't like. So I want to know whether our two speakers actually characterize the nature of globalization, economic globalization, in the same way. It seems to me there probably is a tension, if not a contradiction here. And the second question I want to raise is about the constructive nature of the movements. Well, I agree with the way you've characterized the four myths, but it seems to me that it's one thing to talk about these essentially being myths. It's another to say that we begin to have an imagination, a different kind of political imagination, for a world in which markets can be more toughly regulated, where we can embed welfare and environmental conditions into economic activity, where we can think about how to tame or to render more, not just more transparent, but accountable, the dominant economic institutions of the global order, WTO, IMF, and so on. And I've had two very depressing experiences in this regard recently. One is interviewing chief executives of large multinationals who seem to essentially say that the problem with globalization at this time and the contest over it is a problem of publicity. If only the publicity would be right, if only we were able to get across the message that globalization was essentially benign, then eventually legitimacy for the system would follow. The other equally depressing experience I've had is interviewing a sample from the anti-globalization movements who not only could not agree on what globalization was, but didn't know what the dominant positions were of a developing country with respect to trade negotiations, who thought that, let's say, the position of India, you know, who actually would have been strongly opposing most of the positions taken by the developing world in these trade negotiations, and who themselves, I have to be said, I think, found it difficult to make that link, which is very difficult. So I'm very sympathetic to this, but make that difficult link between, on the one hand, constructive critique, and on the other hand, the elaboration of alternative theoretical terms of reference. This seems to me that, in other words, to put the point slightly differently, I think we do live with a real crisis of legitimacy with our existing institutions. The old state paradigm has run its course. We don't yet know how to create new mechanisms of legitimacy for the wider global system. I'm encouraged by what Meghnad has said about the expansion of global civil society, and I share the same view. But I think now the protest movements have to actually, you know, seize the nettle, as it were. They have to also engage in the more constructive process of political and economic thinking. And that's true for both sides, of course. And that was a question.
Well, if I were to take the time deadline seriously, I would not be able to answer that. Let me give a general sort of answer. I've never thought that capitalism was a benevolent system. Never, ever. I've always thought capitalism, A, is globalizing here to stay. It's a very powerful system. It generates prosperity. At the same time, it generates unequal distribution. I think I even said a sentence about that. Right? I do not think capitalism is a global benevolent system. The point is that I also think that the power of the market to correct certain distributional anomalies are distorted by the global interstate system. So if the global system was not there, I'm not saying capitalism would be benevolent, but at least the ability of people to leave the poor countries and come to rich countries, the ability of countries to trade and play their advantage on trade would be better or would be faster, more efficient than it is at the present, because at the present, the global interstate system, where the more powerful capitalist countries are also more politically powerful, the powerful capitalist countries, whatever they say about markets, are going against the grain of the market and screwing the system. Now, if we didn't have a WTO and if there was no regulation of trade, I bet you trade would liberalize much faster than we have. Now, you know, this lady asked about goodwill. I think the difficulty about goodwill is that, you know, the agenda of a nation state is to protect the livelihood of its citizen if they believe. You know, they don't, in the developed countries, don't actually seriously think that their interests are intertwined with the interests of the poorest countries. They will take terrorism as kind of collateral damage, small insurance costs of that. They don't actually genuinely believe that, because 85% of all transactions are between rich countries anyway, maybe 80% now. So to that extent, it's not even objectively true that they need the developing country. It's not the old Marxist thing in which they're madly exploiting the poor and living on it. That is not it. The thing is, what they are worried about is that if under globalization, as their own capital flows across to poor countries and sets of manufacturing industries increasingly, if that process continues and comes back as trade, their living standards are going to be transformed. And they're not going to allow that. They're not in the business of spreading goodwill or happiness. They're an interest, you know. And all of us are implicit in the system because we are not marching out there against the EU's agricultural policy. It's the most lethal thing ever invented. It's much worse than the 11th of September. I mean, it's much more damaging. What the EU does with the agricultural policy is much more ruinous to third world countries than any terrorist could ever do. But we're not doing that because it's all very technical and there are people. And so I think, I don't think that global change will come through goodwill of the rich countries. But eventually, these sorts of negotiations and illegal movement of goods and people will break down some of these barriers. And eventually, these people have to give up and do something else. I mean, I think at that stage, it may be that people, well, we need a global governance in order to prevent this anarchy of thing which we cannot protect against. So all states are defensive of inequalities. Only after a very long process did the Western European state become partly egalitarian, but very, very slightly so. But that required lots and lots of struggle, lots and lots of violent struggles, mass movements, to make the state even moderately egalitarian. And I think that is why you would need a state, when a global state comes, it will not be a friend of the poor. No state is. But if you have a solid democratic movement, you know, backed by violent struggles, it may just be partially. Yeah. But, you know, let me just finish.
That's not an LSE policy.
Oh, who cares? Now this is non-LSE as defined by our leader. But I've been here longer. let me just finish one little thing. And Adam Smith said something very profound long ago. And he said basically, the thing about capitalism is two things. What he calls system of natural liberty. System of natural liberty brings prosperity. And it brings inequality. But, he said, and this is a real challenge, he said, unequal as capitalist societies are, their poorest people will have better standards of living than what rich people had in the past. That was kind of, you know, I'm putting it very crudely. But what he was saying is that, you know, as goods get cheaper and so on, people consume, even lower level income people have better facilities. And so over time, it's like a Rawlsian proposition. Over time, the level of living of the poorest person improves under capitalism much faster than under any alternative system, despite inequality. And that is a very interesting proposition. Very non-LSE. Thank God.
One more.
Megnat is my boss, so if I disagree with him.
No, I think.
If I disagree with you, you're fired.
Okay. Well, I do believe that intervention is required, divine or otherwise. I think capitalism, I agree with the first part of the Ferguson or whatever, Adam Smith statement, which is that it brings prosperity to everyone. But I do think that if left to its own devices, if it was 100% pure market, the poorest will be very hungry. And we have examples, a lot of examples for that. So some sort of public intervention through government, through norms, through continuous riot or continuous protest movement, whatever the method is, some sort of intervention to shore up this bottom bracket, these pockets of society that are being left out by global capitalism is absolutely necessary. How to bring about that change, I mean, which is a question the person from the audience and David raised. I don't think the movement in its current form is capable of transforming itself into an agenda-setting kind of positive movement that will come up with a new blueprint. I think it is doing and has done enough in terms of raising a red flag, blowing the whistle. It has done enough in terms of engaging people and getting them involved and raising the issues. And most importantly, it has created space where elites, reformers, policymakers, business people can start engaging in defining these new elements. Obviously, the need for the movement is for them to constantly keep the heat up and keep these people on their toes, because otherwise they will go back to their old habits. But in terms of the movement coming up with blueprints and so on, I think this is for elites and not for masses.
Well, before I finally thank our speakers, just to announce that next term there'll be another series of public lectures on globalization, which our colleagues and I have been organizing, and I'll just trail it now, so watch out for announcements. They are a series on globalization and development, inequality, justice, corporate responsibility, and governance. And we have an absolutely outstanding set of speakers lined up. The first lecture on the 29th of January will be Joseph Stiglitz, who will talk about globalization and development. Then Robert Wade from the LSE will talk about the trends in inequality. Robert Gooden from Australia will talk about globalizing justice. John Ruggie, who is Kofi Annan's political advisor, will talk about corporate responsibility. And then Bob Cohane, who's probably one of the foremost IR theory, international relations theorists in the USA, will talk about globalization and governance. So I think they are well worth watching out for and will be a very good. Get there early, especially for Stiglitz. And all that remains for me to do is to thank our speakers for a very lively contribution. Thank you very much.
Thank you.